A thing that looks like a police box standing in a junkyard. It can move anywhere.
Haven, concentrate on Sin. Give priority to the detectors and the navigation systems.
There is a corridor. And the corridor is time. It surrounds all things.
On display, I eventually had to go down to the cellar.
That's the display department.
With a torch.
The lights probably gone.
So had the stairs.
Yours is number 6.
I am not a number. I am a person.
Welcome to British Invaders, episode 501. This is the podcast all about British science fiction television, and this time we are continuing our discussion about Object Z. This is Brian from Canada.
And this is Eamon from England. Hello.
This is a black and white serial for children's television from 1965. It has 6 25-minute episodes, and it is about a mysterious object that is approaching the Earth and threatening the future of humanity. And it is also surprising that it is a piece of children's television because it really doesn't feel like it.
And a recent rediscovery in the archive. So lots of highlights for us to talk about.
Absolutely.
So last time we discussed a little bit about Object Z approaching and Earth's response, and in particular about the scientific community and the military coming together to launch a missile in the hopes of destroying or diverting Object Z. But of course, as perhaps would not be unfamiliar to people in 1965, the missile launch itself fails and the missile goes off course and has to be self-destructed. So it looks like now nothing can stop Object Z, and panic grips the population of the world and its politicians. But at the last moment, when all seems like disaster is upon us, Object Z strangely changes course and enters an orbit around the Earth. Who or what is behind this? What is going on with Object Z and its true nature? The mystery deepens, Brian.
Yes, it opens up more questions for us and for the characters as well. We have America and Russia reacting in a sort of belligerent way, but Great Britain is trying to calm down the warmongers while the scientists are trying to establish some sort of communication with the object, because it's believed that maybe there is something intelligent there if it was able to change course and enter Earth orbit.
Yes, I would say that the show has quite good opinions about scientists generally and the way they're portrayed, and about, I guess, not surprisingly, British politicians, it would seem, right?
Yes. We definitely see it has a higher opinion of Great Britain than it does of the US or of Russia.
Yeah.
Which is hardly surprising, but we definitely see that. And it is a show that has some real respect for scientists and also for journalists, which for me is sort of reminiscent of Quatermass.
Yeah.
And of course, all will be revealed and we won't go into the details of that and how it ends.
We're heading towards a thrilling conclusion, let's say that.
We are indeed. So Object Z deals with some interesting concepts in a way that is surprising for this 5:25 p.m. broadcast slot. Eamon, is this what would typically be called the tea time broadcast slot?
Yeah, it's a tea time slot, slightly older children, but still intended for children's viewing. And it's a show that, for instance, as we discussed last time, deals with the implications and the morality of there not been enough shelters for the world's population, and how do governments decide who will be allowed in and who will be denied entry. And interestingly, there's a suggestion that the British government might limit the selection on some form of the brightest and the best principle. You could almost say eugenics. But the Prime Minister quite categorically rejects this suggestion, which is how we end up with the lottery, and with the Prime Minister himself entering the lottery and not gaining a place, which, I, like I said last time, is astonishing.
Yes. It sort of sits in a very interesting place in British television that we don't see very often. I'll maybe talk about that more a bit later. But the Prime Minister is making broadcasts and clearly believes that sharing the truth with the public as soon as possible is something that he should be doing and that he has to do. And freedom of the press and allowing journalists access to things is sort of held very highly in this show. And even so, we see conspiracy theories and the tendency of the public to react and think that there's more going on that is not being shared with them.
Lots of interesting stuff going on here. And of course, he is interesting, but he's also terrifying. The political figure Keeler, this populist right-wing Britain First extremist with his rants delivered at rallies, he is quite scary. And of course, it's also quite scary to have this general discussion of war, the military, and it's 1965. We are living in the shadow of the bomb. This idea that nuclear paranoia was starting to play an increasing sort of part in the popular culture, something that we have discussed in a film from this era, a later TV show. It's something that's there or thereabouts often in these 1960s science shows.
Yes, very much so. And the memory of World War II is also very strong at this point. So those are sort of influences on this.
Now, I talked last time about how Gwen Bannerman's character, although she is intelligent and asks lots of useful questions, is treated rather badly. We didn't get a chance to mention that there's a Dr. Challis, played by Margaret Neal, who I think actually is the first character on the screen right in the first episode. She is a scientist working at the telescope, and she is quite notable because she is portrayed pretty much as an equal to the other scientists around her, particularly with her male colleague played by Dennis Peake. And there's a nice little hopeful, optimistic subplot, Brian, which is the fact that these two characters are falling in love. And of course, the approach of Object Z has to accelerate that for them. So they actually become engaged during the course of this series, which is quite nice. I quite liked Margaret Neal's portrayal and the way Dr. Challis is treated.
Yes, those two characters are quite nice, and it's very good to see them there for sure. It is worth mentioning that unfortunately we do have a bit of brown face here, with Milton Johns playing a Bedouin leader in the headdress and makeup and everything, which was very much a common thing on television at the time. The way he was portrayed was not the worst we've seen. It was not sort of a comedy portrayal, but it wasn't great.
Looks slightly unfortunate now. We wouldn't do that now, of course, but at the time, as you say, Brian, it was incredibly common on British television.
Yeah.
And in fact, on television, I think on both sides of the pond, really.
Yeah, for sure.
So it's time to talk about what we made of Object Z. We talk about the good points and the bad points. We're going to start, as ever, with the positives. Brian, how would you like to start us off with what you liked about this show?
Oh, there is a lot that I liked about this show. I will start by saying the concept of the unknown object and how that is dealt with more information being revealed over the course of the show. I thought that was very well handled and sort of cleverly put together. So that was really a plus in here.
Yeah, great concepts. And Christopher McMaster's writing, what did you make of that? We get the feeling that he didn't dumb this down at all for its intended audience. What did you make of the writing of the show?
I thought, for the most part, it was great. It was very sharp, and you know, the dialogue was good. It had a sense that it was challenging us to all of these things that could possibly happen in this situation. And that was all very well done.
Yeah, it is, I think, very well written. I don't think Christopher McMaster did make many changes to the script, it would seem. He certainly doesn't introduce any particular child-friendly concepts. This is quite hard-hitting stuff for its intended audience.
Yes, I don't know if anything was taken out from the what would have been the more adult version, but I don't see what that would have been. There's no sense that anything of that type is missing. And there's, yeah, no sense that this is targeted at children at all, from what I can see.
I'm fascinated that we have Daphne Shadwell as producer-director, and that she has such an interesting career. And I'm noting that, you know, we have talked about some very memorable women behind the camera at various points in the early parts of television. I'm thinking obviously of Verity Lambert, but also of, we talked about Irene Shubik on Out of This World and Out of the Unknown. I suppose we could also mention people like Delia Derbyshire, but Daphne Shadwell here directing, and they must have been sort of editing, mixing this show with its various components of stock footage and filmed inserts, and then, you know, the actual on-set performances. They must have been doing that pretty much on the fly, it would seem, Brian.
Yes, absolutely. It had that 1960s feel with doing those very quick productions that were influenced by theater, for sure. And there were, as you say, some women who were behind the camera and who were directors. I have to mention Patty Russell, who was director on Doctor Who and other things in the 60s. So yeah, there were a number of them there. And I think that worked out well in this. Possibly we got slightly better presentation of those two major female characters than we might have otherwise.
And while we talk about the sort of theatrical influences, we can turn to the performances. I will note that slightly sort of, we've only got one take, sweaty feel that it certainly gives me about a show like this. What did you make of the actors and their performances in this show, Brian?
Yes, it does have that theatrical feel to it, you're right. But yeah, I would say that the performances were all good. The sort of political figures with the Prime Minister and with Keeler, they were quite compelling, and our scientists and journalists were too. So they made me want to watch these characters. So yeah, I like the acting in this.
Yeah, it's terrific. Trevor Bannister makes a good lead. Fascinating to see him, the younger version of him, in a show that's played completely straight, unlike the comedy that he would become better known for later on. I thought Julian Summers was terrific as the Prime Minister. And this character, Keeler, played by Arthur White, such a good performance that he is terrifying. And of course, as you said, some of his speeches seem rather sort of prescient to more recent years, Brian.
Yeah, he does, in a way, make me think of the Emma Thompson character from Years and Years, much more recent show, with that sort of starting at the beginning of the political career with not many listening, going up to, you know, this much more powerful situation.
The show is filmed largely on sets, a fair bit of stock footage. Did any of that bother you at all?
No, I was not bothered by that. I think it used what it had quite well, and it definitely looks like something from that era and that style. But yeah, I was not bothered by that.
Yeah, I mean, as you say, it's from that era. I just went along with it. I was slightly charmed by the painted backdrops, particularly when they're sitting in front of a church watching the cricket match, supposedly. I thought that was rather lovely. Yeah, no, it's all pretty good. And of course, it's leading to a big ending that we can't really talk about. But did you find that satisfying?
Yeah, so this is getting more into the negatives. I did not find the ending that satisfying. I was a little bit disappointed by it first viewing. It works, but it was not as interesting as what I had hoped.
Okay, that's interesting. As we say, we can't really talk about it. I did find it quite satisfying. I sort of knew, or had a hint of what was coming. But yeah, I found it perhaps more of a satisfying ending than you did. Before we move into the negatives, I will add the BFI package that we have is delightful, Brian.
It is, yeah. And I will also bring up our two scientists, the man and the woman. It's interesting how those are used. I think I enjoyed their presence a lot. I did find that they sort of gave him a bit more authority, and it would have been nice to have them a bit more equal than they were. But even so, what they did with it was good. I was not as satisfied with the romance between the two of them. It felt a bit unnecessary to me, and sort of in the idea that you couldn't have a man and a woman that you're sort of showing together repeatedly without them including that.
Ah, okay. That's interesting, yeah.
That is sort of its time. But yeah, so that I didn't like as much, but I did like that pairing of characters. I liked both of them individually, and how they put them together and they interacted was nice too.
Yeah. Celia Bannerman's character is slightly less well treated, you know, again, a fairly common role at the time. Her job seems to be to make coffee, look pretty, and ask a lot of interesting questions so that the men can explain the plot. I'm sure that she'd be given more to do if there was a similar show now than then.
Yes, I would think so. It may be relatively realistic to how someone in that job and that position would actually have been treated at that point. But yeah, it's not ideal for sure. It would have been nice to have her doing a bit more.
Hopefully her character rises through the ranks and becomes the director-producer of the science show that they are making.
Yes, that would be very nice.
Obviously, we've mentioned it already, but quickly just to say in the negatives, brown face is always slightly unfortunate. It is there. It's only very brief for one scene. It's not the worst we've seen, but even so, it's still slightly sort of cringy.
Yeah. When that comes up, I always think about the portrayal of the person in brown face. Are they doing a caricature that's sort of a comedy thing, or is it an honest portrayal from that point of view? And this is maybe somewhere in the middle. It's not the extreme comedy version that we saw in Whoops Apocalypse that was very unpleasant, but it's still not ideal as a portrayal, and you do have the brown face there. So yeah, not great and not the most comfortable thing to watch.
A couple of questions for you, Brian. Would this show be better known and better remembered if it had gone out in an evening slot rather than the children's slot, the tea time?
That's a good question. It's possible, because it was still only a few years after A for Andromeda, which was sort of quite well-known and well-remembered, and only 6 or 7 years after Quatermass and the Pit. So it's possible. It's hard to say, but that is possible.
Yeah, I just wonder. I mean, obviously, we're curious as to why it became a children's show,
yeah,
and not an adult show, particularly with the content. But yeah, interesting.
Yeah, and I don't know if British society or British television viewers had sort of moved beyond the 50s and early 60s era shows that were like the ones that would empty out the pubs because everyone had to see the episodes. I don't know if we're still at that point by 65.
Yeah, more choice by then.
Yeah, we were with Quatermass and the Pit. Maybe we were with A for Andromeda, but by this point, maybe it wasn't quite that.
I have one more big question to ask you, but did you have anything else in the negatives about this show, Brian?
I don't have a lot, really. Aside from the odd dated thing with the brown face portrayal we mentioned and how one of the female characters were treated and my thoughts about the ending, aside from those few things, I'm generally pretty positive about this one.
Okay. So one of the great things about doing this podcast is that we discover shows that are quite exciting.
Absolutely.
Does Object Z replace another ITV show also from 1965 in black and white? Undermined, does it replace that show as the great discovery from the mid-1960s?
So for me, I will say no, because it's very good. I'm glad to see it, but it is not not as surprising and not as different as Undermined was.
I would agree, but it's quite close for me. I was pleasantly surprised by this discovery. I think Undermined still rules the 1965 roost, but it's a close one.
Yes. I know you had talked about having major discovery from the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s, and Undermined was the 60s one.
Yes. We have talked about that, some of our big discovery shows for each decade. Yeah.
I believe the others were 1984 and An Englishman's Castle.
Yes, those two are absolutely terrific, and I'd never seen them before doing this podcast. So yeah, Object Z, I think, gets mentioned in the same bracket. Undermine probably still rules the roost, as I've said, for 1965 or the mid-1960s. But yeah, how exciting to find new shows.
Yeah, and the fact that we're mentioning it along with those other shows says something. It's up there. So are we ready to go to our recommendations?
I think we are. I think it might be fairly straightforward. Would you like to start us off?
I think you should start this one, Eamon.
Okay. Well, I'm going to say this is an easy one for me because I had a great time with Object Z. I think it's a fascinating discovery. I'm so glad the BFI have put out this wonderful release. I have watched all the six episodes. I've watched them again with the six commentary tracks and enjoyed those as well. So yes, I am going to recommend a solid thumbs up recommendation. Pay your £20, get this dual disc release, keep encouraging the BFI to put stuff like this out, and watch it. It's great. I really enjoyed it. So that's what I thought. What about over there in Canada, Brian?
So I am slightly more cautious on this one because of the ending, but it is still a remarkable piece of work to look at and has a lot of things going for it. So yes, I will recommend this as well.
Great stuff. If you watch Object Z after listening to our shows, please get in touch and let us know. And if anybody remembers it from when it's first broadcast or the sequel, please, please contact us.
Yes, absolutely. I would love to hear thoughts from the time about this. So, in summary, Object Z introduces us to the idea that there is an object approaching Earth, and it is approaching quickly, and it may be on a collision course. And we see scientists looking at this at telescopes and trying to determine what it is and what's happening with it. And we see journalists following this and getting the information out to the public, and the Prime Minister of Great Britain sharing the information about this with the public. And of course, there is a lot of panic, and there are political things coming into play with a populist politician gaining steam from this, and lots of social reaction to this, and lots of scientific and journalistic investigation happening here, and it will all move towards a very interesting conclusion to this interesting black and white serial from 1965.
Great stuff. Do get in touch and let us know what you thought.
Please do.
And please come back next time and join us as we look at something that's probably more suitable for a child and family viewing audience. It's another version of the children's classic, The Borrowers. We're on the BBC in 2011. And I know I say this all the time, Brian, but we have got a great cast to talk about next time.
Yeah, we really do. So until then, you can find all of our episodes, over 500 of them now, at BritishInvaders.com. And if you search for British Invaders on Facebook, you can find our group there. You can also follow us on Threads and on Instagram. We are at British_Invaders_podcast on both of those platforms.
Yes, please say hello on the socials and tell us what you thought. And please say hello at the Voice of Geeks Network, where British Invaders is a proud member, alongside other shows, gaming content, all sorts of geeky related stuff, at the Voice of Geeks, VogueNetwork.com.
Absolutely. So thank you for listening, and this is Brian from Canada, signing off.
Yes, thank you very much for being with us. Until next time, Eamon in England signing off and saying, keep watching the skies.